Thank you all for coming, and without further ado, I'll introduce our first speaker this afternoon. So Julia Burstyn is a professor in the philosophy department at the University of Kentucky. She got her PhD in 2015 from the University of Pittsburgh in the history and philosophy of science. Yes, there are PhDs in the history and philosophy of science. We are two of them, two different universities, but there are a few universities around the country that do that. And she taught at San Francisco State for a year and until she took up her current position. And she'll be talking to us today, I get your title right, Multiscale Modeling in Nanoscience. That wasn't hard. So please join me in welcoming Professor Burstyn.
All right. Thank you, Alyssa. Thank you, Sergio. Thank you, everyone, for showing up and giving me some of your time on a Friday afternoon. The talk that I'm going to give today comes in three parts. The first part is standalone. It's the part that showcases some research that I've been spending the last year trying to work through and trying to dig into the details on. And I think I've finally gotten it to a point where I can communicate it to someone else. So we're going to try that for the first time here and now. And if I get through that part of the talk, I'll be happy. If I get through that part of the talk and we have some time left, I'm going to tell you a little bit more about first nanoscale alloys and then nanoscale surfaces. And so I know some of you are familiar with stuff that I've done before. Alloys and surfaces are older pieces of research that I am trying to link up to this new example that I'm interested in. And I say new example, it's actually the first old example that I've worked with in a while. Just to explain this cover photo, because we may or may not get to it in the talk, this is a piece of Damascus steel, which is a nanoscale alloy of steel that gives you some nice, pretty structures, and it's the closest thing that I can get to something that looks like geology for the rest of the day. So, as I said, talk's going to come in three parts. We're going to spend most of our time on the first part, this multi-scale simulation of nanoscale crack propagation. I'm going to be saying the word scale a lot today. So we'll get through that and talk a little bit about the use and limits of bulk models in nanoscale alloys, time permitting, and then finish out with my discussion of scale dependence as a modeling constraint. Okay, so let's get started with this multi-scale simulation of crack propagation. This is where the example comes from. It's a series of papers in the late 90s from Abraham and Broughton, they're solid state physicists, who are looking at ways of computer simulating, ways of modeling nanoscale crack propagation in silicon. So this is crack propagation in silicon in silico. It's a computer model. An early computer model of how to couple length scales in order to get more accurate simulation of how a nanoscale crack would propagate. Before I go any further, I just want to flag the nanoscale, at least it said it's very small. It is 1 to 100 nanometers, nanometer 10 to the minus 9th meters, billionth of a meter. So we're talking a few hundredths of the width of a human hair on a good day. So. Very, very small cracks. We're trying to figure out how they propagate in space over time. And this simulation is interesting in part because it is a parallel multiscale model. So instead of taking a macroscopic model at one time step and following it with a microscopic model at the next time step, and a mesoscopic model at an intermediate scale, a mesoscopic model of the time step after that, they're using contributions from each of the scales at each time step. That's what we mean by parallel multiscale modeling or concurrent coupling of length scales. So this idea of concurrent coupling and of parallel multiscale modeling presents an interesting challenge for philosophers of science, and I'm not the first one to bring this to philosophy of science. This is actually an example that was taken up by Eric Winsberg first in 2004. In a paper called Handshaking Your Way to the Top, and later in his book, Science and the Age of Computer Simulation, in the chapter When Theories Shake Hands, in 2010. So the challenge that parallel multiscale modeling presents is that we don't know how to tell stories about the relationship of the component models in a multiscale modeling simulation when we are using contributions from each scale at each time step. So whereas We'd like to tell, say, reductionist stories of how all of the mesoscale models and macroscale models can, in principle or in fact, be reduced to their microscale components. It's easy to tell that sort of story in a serial multiscale simulation. It's harder to tell that story in a parallel multiscale simulation. So that's why Winsberg got interested in this example. That's why I'm interested in this example. The solution that Winsberg presents is a theory of coupling the scales that he calls handshaking. We're going to see that term over and over again. Handshaking actually shows up in the original 1999 papers, the concurrent coupling of length scales papers. They use the term handshake to describe how you connect up micro models to meso models to macro models. Okay, so a little bit more preliminary about these models before we dive in. The model is a multiscale simulation designed to obtain a system-wide Hamiltonian, a system-wide distribution of energy at each time step in the simulation. And we want each time step to represent something like a real-time time step. And we're not talking about second of processor time to second of simulation time. They take a time step at the the vibration mode of silicon, which is something like 10 to the minus 4th seconds is our time step. So the simulation is going a lot slower than the actual time for the crack propagation would, but we're looking for contributions to the energy distribution of the system at each time step in the simulation. Those contributions come to us from three component models plus two handshaking algorithms. And so what we're going to do now is go through the component models and the handshaking algorithms in a little more detail. I'm going to tell you what I think the epistemic issues are in these and how to solve them. That's the plan. Okay. So before we get there, here's just a simple visualization. This comes from the original paper, the 1999 Broughton and Abraham paper. We have in orange, in our large scale simulation here, orange is going to be our macroscale model. Blue is going to be our mesoscale model. Green is going to be our microscale model. And I'll tell you what all of those acronyms stand for as we go through. So our first model, macroscale model, finite elements. And our finite element model models the far field region of the system, that is the region that's distant from the tip of the crack as it propagates. So it acts as a sort of energy sink for the system. When we don't need to know atom by atom details about how the molecules are moving, how bonds are breaking and forming, as the crack tip propagates, we throw the extra energy into our continuum finite elements model. I just said continuum. This is a model that comes to us from continuum mechanics, but finite elements, as the name might suggest, actually discretizes the continuum. And that's going to be important when we start to connect this model up to our mesoscale model. So our equations here, we don't need to know the details, there's not going to be a quiz afterwards, but we have a total linear elastic energy that we start with. Here's our Hamiltonian over here. It's made up of potential kinetic terms, as we'd expect. And we have a finite element approximation, which is made up of a stiffness term and a mass distribution, or mass displacement term, excuse me. So our finite element mesh, which looks like this, discretizes our continuum mechanical description of the system, keeps it in those continuum mechanical terms of stiffness, mass displacement, elastic strain, so on and so forth. And the way we do it is by redrawing our continuum description in terms of finite points. These points are triangular. It's just the way that we do it in 2D. Those points make up what we call a finite element mesh. We call the individual points mesh points. The important thing to note about these mesh points is that the spacing between the points is non-representational. This is a feature of the model that we need in order to make the calculations go through, but all we're doing with those points is giving vertices for our simulation to hook onto, and the way that we would get an actual energy distribution for the system here would be to take the known values at vertices that we're getting from our simulation and then interpolate across the cell region to get our full distribution. Where we put the points, how far apart we put the points, is not a representational feature of the model. So we're not trying to say where individual atoms are by saying where individual points are. It would actually be computationally really inefficient to try to hook up points with individual atoms in the material, not only because the lattice doesn't match up with the lattice of silicon, but also because the point of doing continuum calculations in our macro region is so that we can get away from atom by atom populations. Okay, and finally, this is a decompositional model. What I mean by decompositional is that we start with a total linear elastic energy, and then we decompose it into individual points. So I'm going to be talking about compositional and decompositional models as two different approaches to building these models that we see as we go through. So we decompose our continuum into points here to get the total linear elastic energy of our solid. Okay, feel good? All right. So just as a reminder, that was the orange stuff that we were just talking about, and this is finite elements over here, right? Okay, so now we're going to move into the blue. We have a molecular dynamics model here. Molecular dynamics is rigid body mechanics, right? It's classical. It is discrete, and in this model, it models regions that are intermediately distant from the propagating tip. So we want to know about energy transfer at an atom-by-atom level, but we don't need to know about electron-to-electron transfer. That's important, right? We're going to get to that once we get to our quantum model at the very tip. So we may still see significant displacement of atoms in this model, but we will probably not see we'll still see significant displacement. As I said, this is a classical model. What we have from the particular formulation of molecular dynamics in this model are two-body and three-body terms. So this is slightly more complicated than our most basic two-body interacting rigid body model, but it's still simplified. There are still, we could imagine a rigid body model that models fourth neighbor, fifth neighbor terms. We don't need to for this. And there are reasons that they give in the paper for why two-body and three-body is a reasonable stopping point for a rigid body model. The actual model that we're using is the Stillinger Weber potential, which is here, and you can see here's our two-body term, here's our three-body term, the two bodies I and J, three bodies I, J, K. And what we do with those two-body and three-body relations is calculate forces by composing Newtonian velocity and displacement in the same way that you would sum forces on any sort of x and y axis to get a diagonal force diagram. Yeah? Kind of? Okay. All this is to say that it's classical, right? That's the big takeaway here. You can compose it in a normal classical Newtonian way, and we're doing it through the Stillinger Weber potential. Unlike our classical mechanics, or our continuum mechanics finite element model, the spacing between the points in molecular dynamics represents actual interatomic spacing. That's the important difference between finite elements and molecular dynamics, besides the fact that what we're trying to do is represent atoms here. And notice that representing atom spacing is a fallout of representing the atoms themselves, right? So we have different representational needs that are being met by the molecular dynamics model than we did for the continuum mechanics model. And by representing those interatomic distances, we calculate interatomic forces and sum over them to get a classical rigid body picture of lots of balls moving around in space, right? Okay, good? So again, balls moving around in space, as I just said, this is what we're looking at with molecular dynamics. We're going to move into our third and last component model. This is our micro model, and we're going to call it the tight binding model. So tight binding is a way of representing quantum distributions of electrons, and it's a way of parameterizing those electrons so that we can do nice, easy computer simulations on them. This model is the micro model of the system. It models the propagating tip region, the region where we're seeing the most energy fluctuation, the most displacement. where we need a quantum story about how bonds are breaking and forming and how electron distribution is affecting the movement of the propagating crack tip over time. We can no longer rely on the classical model to do a reasonable approximation of the movement of electrons as we time step the simulation forward. So here we have potential modeled in terms of occupied electronic states up to the Fermi state, the highest electronic, highest occupied state of the system, and inter-electronic repulsive forces. So states apply to the system, and we know electrons in quantum mechanics distribute over the system. That's not a surprise. We also get a way of modeling individual electron forces through our parameterization. So this is a quantum model that is developed from density functional theory, and it decomposes the total energy of the system by parameterizing the electronic structure so that we can get those individual electron terms. So again, this is a decompositional model. Our mesoscale model, molecular dynamics, was compositional. We're composing Newtonian forces here. We're decomposing electronic structure. We parameterize it by something called linear combination of atomic basis functions, which is similar, if you've got any chemistry background in here, to linear combination of atomic orbitals. Same approach, same idea of trying to parameterize the quantum states so that we can perform simpler calculations on them. So this isn't just throwing all of quantum mechanics into a computer. You cannot do that. You can't just throw quantum mechanics into a computer and have something pop out. This is still a simulation model that is simplifying some of the principles of quantum mechanics, but not simplifying it all the way to a classical rigid body system. Okay, those are our component models. So here, in some more detail, are our component models. And I made this chart partly for myself to try and keep track of everything, but also because I think we start to see some conceptual and epistemic differences between the models that make important differences in how we start to combine the models. And that's what I'm going to be talking about for the rest of this section. So we have our macro, meso, and micro models. Again, those are the order that we just looked at them in. Macro model are finite elements. And I divided this out into a couple of different categories. So I'm going to go across the table here and explain. So the kind of model we're using, the actual equations, where are the equations coming from? That's the question that we're answering, the kind of model. Macro, we get finite element theory. Meso, we get molecular dynamics. Micro, we get tight binding, right? Not quantum. Tight binding is the actual implementation of quantum theory that we're getting in that model. The computational tool here, this is the thing that we're doing some calculations on, the way that we are getting the computer simulation to run on the basis of that model. In our macro model, we have mesh points. Again, those non-representational hexagonal points. In our meso model, we have the cylinder vapor potential that is telling us how we're going to get our rigid body mechanics out of the molecular dynamics. And in micro, we have our density functional theory that helps us to separate out the movement of the electron and apply it to individual electrons in the system, even though our tight binding model is modeling multiple electrons in a quantum system. Okay, so those are the sort of nitty-gritty details of what's going on in these models. I want to back up a little bit and talk about what theory of matter we need for each of these models to go through, because this is where it starts getting interesting philosophically. For each of these models, each of the component models, we have to assume very different things about the way the actual material world behaves, different metaphysics. That's what I mean by theory of matter here. Our macro model has a continuum theory of matter. This is, if we have any historians of philosophy in here, I always like to call this the Leibniz theory of matter. Matter is indefinitely divisible forever and ever till the end of time. There are no bottom-out points. Since I know we have geologists in here, I'll say it a little bit more scientifically. Continuum mechanics is continuum mechanics, right? It's a continuum. You model it like a continuum. That's all you need to know. Right? It's not that hard. It's just continuum mechanics. Our meso model, our molecular dynamics, I've said rigid body mechanics a couple times here. That's what it is. It's rigid bodies, so we do have bottom-out points. We do have a classical theory of matter that accompanies them. for what it's worth, they're perfectly elastic collisions as well, right? And then our micro model comes from the quantum theory of matter that we've been working with. Okay, so one question you might ask, and one question that philosophers of science have asked, is which of these is right? Right? Which is real? Which one is the one that actually governs the way the world works? We're not going to answer that question today. Just as a quick shortcut, the answer is all of them. I am not alone, but I'm maybe not in the majority in saying the answer is all of them, and I'll be happy to talk about why I'm not in the majority during questions, but we're just going to leave that there for now. Okay, so another thing that we might ask about is, what is the model actually representing? What is the object in the model that's supposed to hook up to a piece of the target system, the represented system that's in the real world? And the relevant target elements in each of these models differ from one another. So in our finite elements model, in our macroscopic model, the vertex of the mesh point is our target element, right? And we heard earlier that it is interestingly non-representational of a lot of features of the world. It's really summing over the mesh points that's going to tell us something representational about the world from the point of view of continuum mechanics. In our mesoscale model, our molecular dynamics model, our atom as a rigid body with no parts, no nuclei, no electrons, is going to be the representational feature that is supposed to hook up to something in the world, the way that we expect representational models to do. And in our micro model, it's our electron, right? Okay, so those are the more sort of ontological ways of characterizing these different models and starting to see the differences between them. I also want to talk a little bit about the epistemology of these models, how they're formed, how they're built, what we're supposed to take out of them in terms of what they're representing, what they're not representing. So this is a spoiled punchline by this point because I've said it 3 or 4 times already. The inter-element distance, the distance between these target elements, so the mesh point, vertex, the atom, the electron, is representational, is supposed to tell you something about the target system for the micro model, for the meso model, not for the macro model, right? And then our final way of conceiving of these models is the conceptual approach, the way that the model's been constructed out of the theory that it's associated with, so our theory up here, how we got from continuum mechanics to finite elements. We decomposed continuum mechanics, we composed molecular dynamics, we decomposed quantum mechanics, right? Okay. I'm less convinced that this is important, but I think it's an interesting difference between them that may tell us something about the way that modelers are thinking about these different component models. So I'm just gonna flag that there. Okay, so we have all of our component models, and before we move on to the way that these component models hook up to one another, the way they shake hands, I want to talk a little bit about some concerns that I have, concerns that you may have as well. So each of our component models, as I said, make conflicting assumptions about the nature of matter, but they are about different things, they're about different targets. They're developed from different conceptual and methodological approaches. And I haven't shown you this, but I'm going to tell you right now, they can result in different values for a single point in full model space space, which is a problem if you're trying to get a simulation that runs over time and you get divergent disagreeing values. So given all this internal conflict, I want to know what licenses inferences from the model to a target. Now, if you have certain sorts of ontological intuitions and predispositions, one answer you might give is, well, quantum mechanics is all that's really out there, and everything else is a computational tool to make quantum mechanics more convenient. And so what licenses all of this is that we can boil it down to quantum mechanics one way or another, and what we're trying to do with our handshakes is to show how to boil it down to quantum mechanics. I don't think that's the right answer. This will not surprise Alyssa, it will not surprise a few others of you in the room. Winsberg also doesn't think this is the right answer. Winsberg actually picks out this model because he thinks that it shows why giving that sort of answer, which we'll call the reductive answer, breaks down in cases, in instances of parallel multi-scale modeling, because it's not a case of telling the story all the way down to tight binding that gets us to effective parallel multi-scale simulation. Okay, so I'm not going to answer this question yet. We will get there after we go through the handshakes. Here's our first handshake. And a handshake, again, is the algorithm that hooks up a model at one scale to a model at another scale. So we're starting big and going smaller. This is the handshake between our macroscale finite elements model and our mesoscale molecular dynamics model. And these, again, are figures from the original Broughton and Abraham paper in 1999. This is how they describe it, the illustration of the handshake. We have finite element cells contributing to the overall Hamilton at unit weight marked in heavy lines. Cells that are contributing half weight represented by light lines. And then two and three body terms of the cylinder vapor potential carrying half weight across this plane boundary line here. Okay, what does all that mean? Well, here's what happens. In the finite element molecular dynamics handshake, we take that essential non-representational feature of mesh points, the fact that where those points are in space can be determined kind of however we want within computational reason. Way too much coffee before this talk. So within reason, we can deform these points any way we like. So how do we deform them? We deform them so that they line up with the molecular dynamics lattice when we get close to that region where we want that lattice to interact. And that's all we need to do. As soon as we put that spacing there, we do a calculation on this point on the finite element side, we do a calculation on this point on the molecular dynamics side. We switch them, so we do the same calculation over here on molecular dynamics, same calculation over here on finite elements. We slap the values together and we average them. That's all we need to do for this algorithm. All we need to do is deform the finite element lattice to the molecular dynamics spacing, and then we're done. So we take advantage of a feature of one of the component models to make it hook up with the other component model. It's also worth noting the plane boundary here, the boundary where we're dividing one region off from another is between points as opposed to including points. Our contributions are just summed and averaged. Okay, so our meso-micro, our molecular dynamics tight binding handshake, is a little different conceptually. We would expect it to be a little different conceptually because we have different conceptual assumptions going into the component models. So here, I'll let you read the full figure illustration if you like. But what we're doing is constructing a fictional entity. This fictional entity is called a silogen or a syllogen, depending on who you talk to. Here's how you spell it. I like to say silogen because I grew up in a place where there were silos. I don't know why. So I'm going to say silogen. Silogens are fictional entities. They are non-representative of any set of real properties that you would find attached to a real atomic piece of matter. What they are univalent, which is to say, hydrogen-like atoms. So we only have one electron. That's all we need. With silicon spacing. So different elements have different characteristic interatomic spacing. Hydrogen has a different spacing than silicon. We take the electronic symmetries of hydrogen and the spacing of silicon and we slap it together, we have a silogen. In this example, in this handshake, our plane boundary actually consists of rows of these silogen atoms. So everywhere where you see the darker gray touching one of these, we're going to treat that one like a silogen, do our molecular dynamics calculation on that silogen-like point, do our tight binding calculation on the silogen-like point, and again, slap them together and average them. So, good here? Okay.
When you say you do a calculation and then average them,
yeah.
I mean you're finding the energies?
Yeah.
So in the case of the tight binding, you're finding the energies of the electron.
Yeah, so we would, for the tight binding, it would be the energy over the whole region, right? And we tie off the region with these univalent hydrogen-like atoms. So it's not localizing the electron in a classical way. but it's defining the boundary of the region with univalent tie off points. Okay, so at the end of it, we get a visualization like this. This is some number of time steps in that I didn't write down on my notes. We have a strain visualization here, so places of higher strain, higher dynamical changes show up in our blue, fade out to green. We have this sort of nice stress and strain pattern out here. Okay, so I told you before we started looking at these handshakes that I have this question about what licenses inferences from the model to the target. How do we know that this visualization here is anything like the way that nanoscale cracks are actually going to propagate in silicon, right? Especially because we've made conflicting assumptions about the nature of matter, we've made conflicting models about different targets. Those models don't always give us the same value for the same point in phase space. And we've developed these models from different conceptual and methodological approaches. So here's my answer. Each model, as we've said, has a unique set of features, has a unique target. Our finite elements model has mesh points as its target. Our molecular dynamics model has atomic interactions as its target. Our tight binding model has electronic interactions as its target. And we have a unique combination of conceptual approach and a feature that I can't find any shorter way of saying than what counts as representational. That is distinct from every other component model, right? So that was a little bit of a mouthful. Let me say it one more time in a slightly different way. If we were to take the continuum mechanics model and look at what counts as representational in terms of interatomic spacing, in terms of the theory of matter that we're trying to give a simulation life to, if you will, it's going to be different than what counts as representational in our molecular dynamics model, which is going to be different than what counts as representational in our tight binding model. And conceptual approach here, I just mean this compositional decompositional thing that I was talking about. So what I want to say is that these three features, what counts as the target, what counts as the conceptual approach, what counts as representational, constrain and guide how the component models combine. And we've already seen this. This isn't a surprise at this point. We saw that the fact that you don't count the inter-element spacing as representational in continuum mechanics is exactly what licenses our ability to deform that lattice to get it to the molecular dynamic spacing. We saw the fact that both the tight binding and molecular dynamics component models make the same assumption about the atomic nature of matter, namely that matter is atomic, allows us to represent electronic symmetry in a way that licenses the construction of the silogen. So if this is a lot to take in, think about what we had to do conceptually to get this handshake, this finite element molecular dynamic handshake, and see if we can apply that same methodology to the other handshake, right? So for our finite elements molecular dynamics handshake, deforming the lattice, could we do that between molecular dynamics and tight binding? No, we couldn't. Because those lattices, the lattice spacing is representational, right? We also wouldn't need to for molecular dynamics and tight binding. That's a different story. Could we construct a fictional entity that we could perform the same set of calculations on for our FEMD handshake in the same way that we did for molecular dynamics tight binding handshake? I'll give it to you here. The answer, again, is no. We couldn't construct an entity that we could perform both sets of calculations on because continuum mechanics and molecular dynamics make very different assumptions about what counts as an entity in a theory of matter, right? Okay, so the point is that it's particular features of the component models themselves that guide how we're going to construct these handshakes. And here's where I think Winsberg went off the rails a little bit, or maybe just didn't go far enough off the rails. So what Winsberg writes about this example, he says, fictions can help us to sew together inconsistent model building frameworks and to extend those frameworks beyond their traditional limits.
So Winsberg's not interested in the dirty details of the simulation in the way that I am. And I think that was actually a mistake that he made. He said that handshakes let us get away from reduction and emergence. That's the big upshot for him of this example. We have parallel multi-scale modeling. We can't reduce. We can't have the alternative to reduction, standard philosophical alternative to reduction is emergence. You have genuinely novel phenomena that show up at our mesoscale or our microscale that simply can't be talked about in our microscopic terms. And what Winsberg does want to point out, and does point out, is that we do get these different component models to talk to each other. But then he stops and he moves on to the climate models. And I think if he had kept going, and if he had kept, it, rather than stopping with fiction, sew components together, had said how they sew the components together and how the details of the different component models constrain the way that we can and the way that we should sew those models together, we would have had a more robust story of what I'm calling epistemic warrant. I think that this full multi-scale simulation is epistemically warranted by the choices that the modelers made about how to connect the targets across across the component systems, across the different conceptual and representational schemes. So another way of saying this whole big thing is to say that handshaking is a beginning, not an end. Unlike at certain presidential debates. Okay, how am I doing on time?
Another 5 minutes.
Okay. So I told you, if I got through the first section, I'd be happy. I got through the first section. This is the big upshot at the end of this first section. Models epistemically warranted by the modeler's choices about how to connect targets across different conceptual and representational schemes. I'm going to skip the discussion of alloys for now, and I think I'm actually just going to tell you that I have a lot of other cool things to say, and you can talk to me about them in Q&As and later. And I'm going to skip to a big summary at the end that lets you see how this hooks up to some other things that I'm thinking about in nanoscience these days. So if we were to look more carefully at alloys in nanoscience, alloys are solid metal mixtures, two different phases of metal that come together in non-molecular ways. Alloys are really interesting because they have macroscopic properties that are homogeneous and mesoscopic properties and microscopic properties that aren't. And so there's a big question about how to explain all of the heterogeneity at smaller scales in terms of the homogeneity at larger scales. And you can ask that question for macroscopic alloys and then push that same question into the nanoscale and look at the way that the question fares. And the answer is that the question fares reasonably well in nanoscale alloys up to a point. And that point is for the alloys that we're looking at, usually around 5 or 10 nanometers. Around 5 or 10 nanometers, nanoscale alloys stop behaving like macroscopic alloys and start behaving like distributed surfaces. And so we move from bulk scale alloy models to surface scale alloy models. Surface-scale alloy models are different than bulk-scale alloy models, and I use this whole big story to make the point that we have a limit, a 5 to 10 nanometer limit, on how much we can extend the concept of alloy into the nanoscale. And that limit of conceptual extension constrains our multi-scale modeling choices when we're trying to describe how alloys work. I think that that is a way of starting to say what sorts of choices we're making. I showed you a sort of case-by-case study of what the choices were that we made in the nanoscale crack propagation simulation. What I want to do is use the discussion of alloys to start to give us a sense of what kinds of things are constraining those choices on a broader than just different things are different sort of story, right? And my answer to what sorts of things constrain those choices is scale. So we see it in alloys. We see it in this idea that I have called scale dependence, which I enter as an alternative to reduction and emergence in that sort of system of inter-theory relations. I think scale dependence can actually be understood as a constraint on modeling. which systematizes and guides conceptual constraints across the board, at least for nanoscience, and hopefully beyond. And I apologize that those two sections went very quickly in the course of one slide, rather than slide by slide as I originally intended. But to say it all one more time, slightly differently, this is what we spent our time on today, the idea that epistemic warrant for a model, what allows us to trust it, what allows us to believe that it is representing the target system that it's representing, issues from how our component models are combined in multi-scale simulations. Not just that they're combined, not just that they're combined in parallel, not just that they're combined non-reductively, but how they're combined through these handshaking algorithms, through the details of those handshakes. But those details are not just case by case. Warranted strategies take into account the limits of applicability of concepts imported from higher and lower scales. And I think scale dependence rationalizes and systematizes the limits of applicability by guiding modelers through their search space. So I think I'm going to leave it there. Thanks.